Welcome to episode 38 of the Golf Talk Podcast, the post Ryder Cup edition. We've managed to crawl out from our holes and resurface as Americans, despite the beatdown that we received. I'm Eric Barseski, joining me as always from Washington, Jeff Smith. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Eric.
Yeah.
It was ugly. I mean, to be honest with you, I couldn't. There were many, many times I just couldn't watch. I would rather have watched Oprah, which I did, than some of the some of the painful moments that we had this past weekend.
Right. Well, we're going to retrace the steps painfully one round at a time. We're going to start with the Friday morning four ball, which saw Tiger Woods and Jim Furyk get off to a decent start while winning one up over Puttering Harrington and Colin Montgomery. Stewart Cink and J.J. Henry. J.J. Henry had a nice run at the end. I think he went eagle birdie in that round. Perhaps that was another one. But halved his match with Cink and against Casey and Carlson. Sergio Garcia won everything until his singles round, this time pairing with fellow Spaniard Jose Maria Olazabal to beat David Toms and Brett Wederich, who stunk up the joint.
And yes, they did.
Darren Clarke and Lee Westwood. Lee Westwood also tied Sergio for 4 points on the Euro side, defeated Phil Mickelson, who stunk up the joint, and Chris DeMarco, who didn't do much better.
Yeah, well, incidentally, Brett Wederich was the one guy that he lived up to my expectations, let's put it that way.
He lived down to our expectations.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, so 2.5 to 1.5, and that was a theme that would repeat. In the afternoon foursomes, which some call alternate shot, we have 3 matches and lost to Sergio Garcia. Tiger Woods lost that match with Jim Furyk, playing against Sergio Garcia and Luke Donald. Saturday.
And that was a match when they had a chance at it, but of course Jim Furyk dunks a ball in the water. What was
on
that,
18.
On the 17th?
That was on 18, yeah. Curse splat. Just dropped the club as soon as he hit it. Knew it as soon as he hit it. Saturday morning four balls. Stewart Cink and J.J. Henry again came back late in their match to have their match against Paul Casey and Robert Carlson again in a rematch. Garcia and Olazabal knocked off Phil Mickelson and Chris DeMarco. A task I think your mother and my mother probably could have done. Playing left-handed. Darren Clarke and Lee Westwood knocked off Tiger Woods and Jim Furyk, setting them 0-for-2 in the last 2 matches there. And Scott Verplank and Zach Johnson. Zach Johnson came alive on the back, had something like 5 birdies on the back 9 alone. Knocked off Henrik Stenson and Padraig Harrington. Interesting note is Padraig Harrington and Paul McGinley, the Irish guys, were pretty much winless in the Ryder Cup, so hosted in Ireland, and the Irish guys didn't fare so well. Saturday afternoon foursomes, Sergio Garcia wins again against Phil Mickelson and David Toms. Probably not his toughest match. Chad Kimbrell and Vaughn Taylor playing together have their match against Colin Montgomery and Lee Westwood, one of the few matches Lee Westwood didn't win. Tiger Woods and Jim Furyk managed to hold off Padraig Harrington and Paul McGinley, the Irish guys we just talked about. And Stewart Cink and Zach Johnson got their butts handed to them by Paul Casey and David Howell. That sent the Americans into the final round, singles round, down 10-6, which happened to be the same score as 1999 when they pulled out a miracle at Brookline. Sadly, the Americans needed 8.5 points out of 12, which, you know, is a lot. You know, that's winning 8 matches, tying 1, and losing only 3. And yet, the Europeans were the ones that managed to get 8.5 points on the final day, winning, in the end, by the same score as the Americans lost, or that they won by, in Oakland Hills 2 years ago, the worst loss ever, 18.5 to 9.5. Equaling that score. What was the problem?
They were flat all week. They played tight. I think, to the Europeans' credit, they just played well. They played better. The one observation that I had was that I forgot it.
The observation I had was that 2.5 to 1.5, repeated 4 times, is a 4-point deficit, obviously, going into Sunday. But yet, of all those matches that were halved, if the U.S. could have won the last hole, or won one extra hole, just which is a matter of one more putt going in that didn't go in, those matches are 2-2 every time, and we go into the final day 8-8. Just one putt in 4 matches, 4 different times, had to go the Americans' way, and it'd be 8-8. This was the most closely contested blowout I think I've ever seen. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. I mean, there was a lot of key moments that the United States should have come through or could have, and they didn't. The observation that I did have was that, you know, had some putts gone the United States' way, we'd have seen a lot more team camaraderie, a little more high-fiving, people would have been more loose, and you might have said about the Americans what we've ended up saying about the Europeans, that they played loose, they were smiling, they were happy. Well, of course, it's pretty tough to be happy when you're just getting slapped around.
I don't think you can have team camaraderie when you're losing, too. I thought the Americans showed a brilliant amount of team camaraderie in 1999. You know, certainly, you know, racing out to celebrate and everything, that's the camaraderie there. I think the camaraderie thing is an excuse we have, you know, oh, we don't have the camaraderie. Of course you're not. You've lost 18.5 to 9.5. How much camaraderie can you really display in losing?
Yeah, well, that's it. You can't. You're not going to be happy. And the criticism was, oh, you know, the Americans are so sour and the Europeans are happy and all that. Well, of course, yeah. You know, it's no. Everybody knows why that is, because we were losing.
Of course, Tiger Woods, the leading point earner for the United States team in a losing effort, finally with a winning record in the Ryder Cup, going 3-2-0. Stuart Sink, captain's pick Stuart Sink, point out, tied for second. Played all five matches, won 2.5 points. I thought one of the keys was if the rookies went 500, that the rest of the American team should be able to play just better than 500, and that obviously would be enough to win. Just better than 500 is all you need to win, obviously. And yet, the rookies didn't, and then we had our stars, quote-unquote, like Phil Mickelson, who we'll talk about later, winning a half a point, despite playing in five matches. You know, I mean, our rookies played, some of them played well. J.J. Henry, I'll give him credit. Zach Johnson, I'll give him credit. Vaughn Taylor did reasonably well, winning half a point. Brett Weber stunk up the joint. So David Toms had a chance playing late on Sunday, but threw a ball in the water on 15, I believe, right after the moment, after three putting. So, you know, a lot of chances and a lot of times when veterans didn't step up. Phil Mickelson, yeah. David Toms, Chris DeMarco, I'm looking at them.
Well, if Phil Mickelson himself would have played better, I mean, his total was 0-4-1. I mean, four losses. I mean, the guy was just completely flat. So, yeah.
Right.
There you go.
Well, even if you take Phil Mickelson's four losses and turn them into wins, that adds 4 points to our side. That's suddenly 13.5. That's a 1 point match at that point, or really a half a point match. So that's all we needed out of him. And yet we see people like Sergio Garcia, who can't putt to save his gonads in a regular tour event when he gets near the lead, putting lights out in these team events. Granted, he got beat down in singles, but I think Stuart Sink in singles on Sunday was about 40 under, you know, and beating Sergio Garcia 5-4. So can't blame Sergio there. He was still making putts and things, but I think this is more evidence of the fact that with Sergio, it's not a technical thing with his putting. It's all a mental thing. Someone made the comment maybe that it had to do with someone else reading the lines for him, helping him read his putts, his partners, like Luke Donald. And if that's the case, he certainly needs to hire a caddy that can help him read putts when he's playing in stroke play events. Or if he just has a different attitude, like, ha-ha, I'm going to show them, or whatever. You know.
Well, it was really obvious that Sergio fed off of the energy of his team. He loved it. How many times do we see Sergio in an interview say, oh, I just love it, this is what I live for, this is my favorite event? You know, so he likes that. He enjoys it. He loosens up, and I think you find he's really tight in stroke play events, and he gets out there, and he just can't putt because he overanalyzes, overthinks, expects too much of himself, and I think that's a great observation. He plays really tight stroke play, but for some reason he just loosens up and has a good time.
Right. Well,
in this event,
newsflash to Sergio: nobody's going to care about you in 20 years if you never win a major, but you play great in the Ryder Cups. Sad to say, he may be a captain someday on the Ryder Cup teams, but nobody's really going to care. You know, he needs to start learning to love the pressure of a PGA Tour event or a PGA Tour major, as much as he loves the Ryder Cup, I think.
That's right.
I don't know. We'll have a bit more to say on these Ryder Cups, but we don't, frankly, it's depressing to talk about, so we're not going to talk about it much longer. But we got one more bit in us, so we'll be right back after this message from Titleist and Chip Shots from Golf Gods.
For a crisper long iron, grip up on it about an inch.
Be real aggressive through impact.
Keep it short and aggressive.
Maintain your balance.
Take one more club and swing it smooth.
Think happy thoughts.
For a soft draw, close your stance and make sure you release the club.
I'm going to lounge my feet to the right a little bit, hook the club face, then grip the club.
You can learn a lot from the world's best players.
And one more tip, trust your tightest.
Oh, that's got to be it, guys. Come on, that's a perfect shot.
From the studios of GolfGods.com in Minneapolis, this is Chip Shots, a weekly look at golf equipment news, brought to you by the staff of GolfGods.com, the official online pro shop of thesandtrap.com.
This week on Chip Shots, White Hot. In the past 2 weeks, Odyssey Golf announced the introduction of four new models to its popular line of Odyssey White Hot XG putters. The new offerings include the same White Hot XG9 model Phil Mickelson used in April to win both his second Masters title and his third Bell South Classic title the week before. In unscientific testing at the Golf Gods World Headquarters, product specialist Nick Thompson experimented with the new putters and quickly established a bond with several models, including the radical-looking number 7 with its fangs, as Nick called them, or lineman wings, as described by Odyssey. What Nick described as he sank putt after putt across the undulating floor of the headquarters into a drinking glass was nearly the same confidence-inspiring take Phil Mickelson had. To wit, the XG putters have a super soft insert technology, and they have tremendous feel regardless of the ball being played. Some say the softest insert on the market today. Nick, who relies on a variety of tactile cues when putting, liked the super soft Odyssey grip and said that the insert did feel noticeably softer than any of the other inserts he's played. With the number 5 mallet, Nick's preferred putter style, the tremendous balance made it easy to keep the face square through the entire stroke from start to finish. What I liked about this line was the price. While other premium putters hover around the $200 price point, this line is value priced at $119 retail, making it an affordable option for some of the best putter technology on the market today. And you can see the entire lineup at the golfgods.com website. Well, that's it for Chip Shots this week. Now back to the podcast.
Welcome back. In today's forum topic of the week, we're talking about Phil Mickelson. One of the forum members going for the green posted this topic, Phil's Nightmare Continues, and his point was that since number 18 at Wingfoot, he's really fallen apart. And so, Eric, give me your view on that whole situation.
Does that summarize my viewpoint? I always thought Phil was kind of a fake before, and I didn't really like him. He's capable of playing good golf, but I didn't really like him as a guy or someone I really rooted for. Now, I almost find myself rooting against him and disliking him. My needle has tipped that direction, because, fine, you care about the majors, but when you have a press conference after the PGA and say, yeah, I'm pretty much done for the year, and the Ryder Cup's coming up, and then 2 years previous, you switch equipment the week before the Ryder Cup, it makes me, not put you on my good list.
I think this is indicative of what we've seen from Phil in the fall just about every year. I mean, this isn't any different than other years. I mean, we were talking about this last year that he just goes flat. I mean, after the majors, he just kind of gives up. And hopefully this is a wake-up call for Phil because, I mean, the Ryder Cup's an important event. There were some in the media who were downplaying it and they're saying, is the Ryder Cup that important? Well, yes, it is. And the Europeans are playing wonderfully in the Ryder Cup. And it's time for the United States to step up and play. And Phil Mickelson has got to be one of the most critical components of that. I mean, he's ranked second in the world right now. So get on the bandwagon and plan on playing well in the fall.
He's certainly old enough to be a team leader. He's older than Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods talked about how this was his time to step up. At what point has Phil Mickelson ever stepped up and taken a leadership role? If you're trying to lead by example, his example is, I don't really give a shit.
Right.
And that's... Well, it's despicable.
Well, the thing that I see is also if Phil Mickelson's game came to maturity a little later in his career. I mean, we're looking at now finally, 3 years later, he's a major winner. But there were years and years and years and years that we were watching Phil Mickelson, and he was the best player to not have won a major, et cetera, et cetera. And so now I think he's matured late, and he's going to have to say, hey, listen, I only have a few years left. I want to take a leadership role in the fall in the Ryder Cup, President's Cup events. Take it seriously.
He's not going to deserve a leadership role. Age and three majors alone doesn't get it to you. When you can go two Ryder Cups in a row and not give a crap, then that doesn't show any kind of goodwill or it's not leading by example in the least. It's despicable. I mean, that's all I can really say. He looked as if he didn't really care the whole time. We've seen him in the final rounds of like the PGA or the British when he's nowhere near the lead and he's basically going through the motions. That's what he looked like the entire week, Ryder Cup week. Last year at Oakland Hills, not only did he switch equipment, but he went off and practiced on a different course away from the team. because that's what he does when preparing for the majors. I don't care. It's not a major. It's a team event. And he showed absolutely no regard for his team back then. And by his play and his preparation this year, he once again showed absolutely no consideration for his teammates. So,
well, it was definitely disappointing to see his record.
0-4-1 is horrible. He could have put in the work and prepared and still had a bad record, and I wouldn't be saying these things. He doesn't deserve to be a team leader, and yet he probably helped bring the team down just by failing to lead by example. I mean, he just looked like he was wandering around in a daze the entire week. So,
yeah. Well, we'd like to encourage our listeners to stop by the forum. We will have this post up for you to click on. And so weigh in on Phil's Nightmare Continues at our forum. We'll be back after an ad by Titleist.
In the heat of competition, you should really stick to your go-to shot. For me, that's a tight little draw.
Copy your practice swing and don't think about results.
Just take your time, keep everything nice and slow.
When I'm under pressure, I think about my kids.
I think of my kid too.
Keep it simple, play one shot at a time.
Don't be tentative, stay real aggressive.
Make sure and drink lots of water.
Concentrate on concentrating.
Don't think too much.
Just remember to breathe.
And don't panic.
And one more tip,
trust your Titleist.
You can learn a lot from the world's best players.
Did you get the sense I don't like him?
Yes.
But seriously, what an ass.
You know, I didn't observe him.
They didn't show him much because he was playing so badly.
Yeah, you know, so I don't really have any... My opinion of Phil Mickelson hasn't been swayed either way other than the fact that, like, he didn't do squat, which is pretty big.
PGA. He gagged it around at the Bridgestone. He plays hit and grin golf the whole after the PGA.
Well, the thing you pick up about Phil is he doesn't take it seriously. He takes, like, he's chosen the things that he's serious about, and that's winning these major championships and everything, but he's not a guy who jumps in both feet and enjoys a team thing. So, yeah, that's your point.
I don't know. I just, like I said, when we first started, we never really answered the question, by the way. I think the 72nd hole at Wingfoot has had an effect on him. You know, his play at the British and his play at the PGA, I think, shows that.
So, you know, I guess Phil goes flat in the fall anyway, so, but it's hard to really know.
He enters, like, this woman depression where he just goes home and eats Haagen-Dazs and gains weight and doesn't care about the world.
I hope you include that.
Well, I think we should include that whole part there. So let's just move right in here and welcome back. You've been back. Yeah. Kari Webb here. Kari Webb, we're talking about other stuff now because we're done being depressed. Kari Webb, also not from America.
Yeah, she steps in there and wins. She has four victories in 2006, so she's won against Annika Sorenstam, who was kind of on her heels all afternoon.
At the long strug challenge, yeah. Australians can beat Swedish people. We can't.
It can be done. It definitely can be done. We didn't see it last weekend, but...
Right. So this win puts Kari Webb in contention. She's still behind Lorena Ochoa for Player of the Year on the LPGA Tour. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see her win it. It's certainly an impressive resurgence by Kari Webb. People have made the comments, oh, it's almost like it's 1998 again or something, so...
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been kind of fun to see some different faces on the LPGA Tour this year, you know, Kari Webb being one of them. The other one I'm thinking of is Christy Kerr. Obviously, Annika Sorenstam hasn't had her massive winning year, but she's played very well.
It's odd, too, that we were talking at the beginning of the year about the young guns on the LPGA Tour. You know, the Paula Creamers, the Natalie Goldises, the Lorena Ochoas. Lorena has stepped up. Michelle Wee, when she's played on the LPGA, has fared well. But yet, you know, we've got Christy Kerr having a good year again. I guess she's semi-young. But then we've got Kari Webb, who nobody saw coming.
No.
They're kind of coming out of nowhere. I forget the Sari Park is the other one.
Yep.
Certainly not the young gun on the LPGA Tour, but, you know, coming back from previously illustrious careers and resurfacing. So it'd be interesting to see what happens next year. I don't know that the Paula Creamers of the world are going to beat out them Kari Webbs of the world again next year.
Yeah, well, and another, you know, to Morgan Pressel's credit, she finishes third at 1,200 at the same event.
I think her highest finish of the year, I think.
So there she is. Of course, that's one of the young guns you were just referring to, and we haven't seen much out of her except for tears.
Yeah, she's been MIA pretty much all year, so.
Yeah, well, another guy MIA until this point is Axley. Eric Axley just won this past weekend at the Texas Open.
The PGA Tour had an event this past weekend. Did you know
they
that?
Did. You know what? I didn't even know it till I read this.
So. Yeah, the Valero Texas Open. I think that it's great that Axley won. Good for him. I also think it would be nifty if, like, alternate field events, like opposite the majors or opposite Ryder Cups or things like that, if they maybe gave the guy a one-year extension to his PGA Tour card, because, I mean, these aren't events. I mean, you haven't seen this guy's name yet this year, and yet now he has a two-year exemption.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the guys that win the BC Open or whatever, opposite, you know, the British Open. It's like...
Well, I'm going to disagree with you. I think that, you know, guys that sneak out wins like this, I think they deserve their 2 years in the sun to have a go at it. Maybe it'll give Eric Axley a little momentum for the future.
Okay, but answer this. How is winning this event harder, say, for example, than winning a nationwide tour event?
Because you have some more experienced people than the nationwide tour does. I think you know the people that he wins over obviously aren't the guys that are playing in the Ryder Cup this weekend, but there's still some pretty big names out there that he beats.
I suppose. Check the leaderboard. I mean, Chris Ryder.
It's a weak argument, but.
I mean, he beat Frank Licklider, Ted Purdy, and Chris Riley, so weak argument, but I'll let it slide. Like I said, 1 year I think should be fine, but a guy lost nearly $500,000 because he bet $465,100 on the United States to win. Called the biggest bet in golf history. He was given odds of 6-5, which means he would have won $1.03 million if Phil Mickelson had gotten off the Haagen-Dazs and played golf. along with some other Americans.
Well, I'm man enough to admit that I picked the United States to win the Ryder Cup, but I was not going to wager $465,000,
right,
on that.
I wouldn't bet $4.65 on it.
Not anymore.
But yeah, you and I are the only two people on our staff to pick the U.S. to win.
Whoops.
But we know, we've learned our lesson. Sorry. We'll
I apologize.
We'll pick the international team next time. I promise. Right. Michael Jordan was, of course, rooting for Tiger Woods and was at the K Club in Ireland to root on the team. I'm not sure that having him there really helped things at all. It kind of distracted from the U.S. team, you know? I mean, people know that he's Tiger's buddy. And I think were I Tiger, I would have said, you know what, Michael? I'm taking this leadership role this year. Kind of stay away a little bit, you know? You can watch and whatever, that's fine. But try not to be all chummy with me and stuff, because I really have to focus on my team this year. I felt that it kind of distracted a bit from Tiger the teammate versus Tiger the individual.
You know, I think that people understand that Michael Jordan played basketball a few years ago, and Tiger's the man who's in the spotlight now. Obviously that could be distracting to Tiger. I think Tiger's enough of a competitor to be able to kind of let it slide. You know, his friend's there, and that's all it is.
Well, I think it's distracting to his teammates is what I'm saying. People are like, okay, oh, there's Michael Jordan to root on Tiger. Okay, great. When Tiger should have been helping to root on his teammates a little
bit. I was just thinking that it probably was a little embarrassing for Michael Jordan to be sitting there watching the United States getting, you know, disrobed by the Europeans.
I think he was about to tee it up.
Yeah.
He's not one to bet $465,000 on the U.S. team. I think he has his gambling problems, but he's a little smarter than that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, another guy who appears to have bled profusely at golf, just like the United States did last weekend, would be a Japanese golfer, Mitsuhiro Tateyama. So he made a 19 on a par 3 over the weekend. He took 14 strokes in... Okay, this... Yes, I'm going to say it. In a bush.
14 strokes in a bush. He made a...
It was ugly. And we can...
It was
an
ugly bush.
You can appreciate the humor, but it was ugly. Moving right along.
Moving right along.
Moving well along. Erica, you had some comments perhaps about this tape delay, the Ryder Cup on tape delay. Of course, it starts for me. It started at about 2 a.m., and so we're watching the tape delay all day. How did that kind of work out for you? Were you disappointed? Did you stay with the TV coverage or what?
It's obnoxious. It's obnoxious that in this day and age, you know, they always say the rule of live TV is if you have something going on live, show it. I don't see what would be so wrong with what happened was, you know, coverage started here at about 8 a.m., and then play started in Europe at 8 a.m., 5 hours ahead of us on the East Coast. So by the time we were watching the morning rounds, they were already teeing off in the afternoon. So, you know, if you happen to, like, drop by an internet forum or look online or, heaven forbid, someone call you on the phone and blurt out the score, you had 5 hours of sitting there going, okay, U.S. loses 2.5, 1.5, now what? It's just retarded. I don't know that NBC or USA would have gained a whole lot of viewers sitting there watching whatever versus showing stuff live. The whole day was spoiled because you could find out very easily, have it spoiled for you or otherwise, what the results were, and then you're sitting there picking your nose going, yeah, okay, whatever.
Well, I think it would have been very easy for the networks to roll all of those great shots into a highlight film, and they could have kept that going in between live coverage if there's some dead spots and so on. Forget a billion commercials and keep some highlights going. That would be a very easy way to keep us interested and also, you know, keep us going with the live events.
4 years from now, when it goes back to Europe, they can figure something out. Because the whole, you know, whether it's web streaming that works or what, something needs to be better. Because it was horrible to... People here in the States had no interest in watching stuff when they already knew the outcome, basically. That about does it for episode 38 of the Golf Talk Podcast, brought to you by thesandtrap.com. If you want to try to kick off next week's forum topic of the week, drop by our forums at thesandtrap.com/forum. For Jeff Smith, this is Eric Barzeski saying, USA. Yeah, forget it. I give up. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
All right, we'll see you next time.